Hello everyone, it's a great pleasure to be here. This talk is part of the program on frustrated magnetism in quantum spin liquids, and the purpose of this talk is to give you an experimental viewpoint on some of the challenges and opportunities in this field to look at cooperative ordering and dynamics in magnets and look for emergent phenomena. This will be a sort of a mixed theory experiment talk, so I hope you'll allow me to show some slides later on with data. We all know that the origin of magnetism comes from the fact that the electron has a spin angular momentum, spin a half, that's truly a quantum property. And so magnetism is all about the cooperative ordering of all the spins under the effect of interactions. The motivation for the current workshop is to understand the key ingredients when emergent phenomena happen. In this talk, I'm going to describe some well-understood paradigms of magnetism and their manifestation in experiments, and discuss some of the challenges to look for quite exotic phenomena currently predicted in quantum spin liquid. To fix ideas, let's start with an insulator which has magnetic ions on a lattice, and magnetic ions have an unfilled electronic shell, so they have a magnetic moment, which I'm going to call Si. And then these spins interact typically with a Hamiltonian, which is pairwise in the spins, of the form sum of the four pairs, dot product Si Sj. That's typically the form. And this Jij is an exchange interaction and arises from, is fundamentally a Coulomb origin, and arises from the fact that depending on the spins of the electrons, they can or cannot hop through the lattice via the orbital overlap, and that affects the electrostatic energy. And so I'm going to first consider the simple case when all the exchange interactions are positive, and that's the case of ferromagnetic interactions. And so the T equal to 0 ground state in this case corresponds to everybody else. So when we think in terms of dynamics, we want to look at what happens if we introduce a defect into this ground state. And a defect is, of course, if you take a spin away from full alignment. Now I'm going to consider the case, the simple case, when we have all the spins a half. And so a defect corresponds to flipping a spin at some side r in the lattice. Now it turns out that this is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, because if I apply the Hamiltonian to it, this spin flip will actually be hopped on other sides of the lattice as well. So if we expand this dot product here, Sz and Z plus a half x plus minus plus x minus x plus, then one can easily show that when the Hamiltonian is applied onto this spin flip state, then we get the energy of the ground state plus the energy of flipping the spin. So that will be all of the sum over all the bonds that we've changed. The delta. So if the spin is a half, then the energy is minus J by 4, and so we go from minus to plus because we've solved the sign. So this factor through here. So that's the state with spin aside R. However, these other terms in the Hamiltonian, actually in particular this one up here, will act on the state and flip the spin up and a nearby spin down. So there'll be a sum. So this part of the Hamiltonian would actually hop the spin flip on neighboring sides. So we've got hopping of a spin flip. And one can construct eigenstates of the problem, and these are plane wave superposition of spin flip states. So the eigenstates are actually plane waves of states with spin down at all sides of the lattice with a phase factor e to the ikr and some normalization factor. So this is what we call a spin wave state. And there's a well-defined energy associated with this, which one can show starting from this. It's related to the Fourier transform of the exchange couplings. So if we plot this graphically, then we've got, as a function of energy, there's a dispersion relation. And at low energies, this is gapless. And it's related to the fact that ordering corresponds to breaking to continuous symmetry. So that's a Goldstone boson. In order to build a semi-classical picture of what the spins are doing inside one of these excitations, it's also an anti-factor exercise to show that the perpendicular spin components, so the expectation value at different sites of the lattice, are actually in a relationship like this, which basically means that if all the spins are vertical, then this, inside a spin wave, the transverse spin components oscillate, and so one can think of a spin wave as a precession of the spins around the equilibrium direction. I'll switch some of that off. Okay, so if this is the ground state, then a spin wave oscillation corresponds to like a wave of spin, if you like. Where the energy is associated with the wavelength. Okay. So we know that this picture is true because we can experimentally measure the thermodynamics of the system and then find out that it's well described by a gas of spin waves or magnons. And also, one can measure the magnons directly via neutron scattering. Neutrons have a spin themselves, a spin a half, and so when they scatter off a magnetic system, they can flip a spin, and so they can create one of these excitations. And so, because a spin wave is a coherent propagation of a single spin flip, what happens, neutrons locally flip a spin, and that propagates as a long-lived excitation. So the signature neutron experiment is that of a child mode, where the width in energy is resolution limited. So the key signature here is that at a given momentum, there's only a single energy for which neutrons can excite the system. And so that is experimentally seen as a sharp peak in the neutron cross-section. So Yes?
Is there an energy gap in this picture?
Okay, so here I show the data actually is in a system where you also have an applied magnetic field and there's some anisotropy, so that's the reason for this energy gap. I didn't have a nice color picture of a conventional ferromagnet to show, but this illustrates the point. So, the question we want to ask is whether this picture actually describes all of the magnetism in condensed matter, or whether there are situations where new types of excitations could exist. And one example that I'd like to discuss is that of solid cones in one-dimensional Ising chains. So if we consider a Hamiltonian or ferromagnetic Ising chain. So Ising means that only the Z-spin components are interacting. So here, if we calculate the specific heat of the system, again, that's a standard exercise in quantum graduate physics, we find that it's exponentially activated. However, the gap, and the gap comes out to Bj by 2. This is somewhat surprising because if you consider the ground state, of course, spins up, and you think that a natural excitation is one spin down, this actually costs of energy dead. So the reason for this is that this state is degenerate with many other states where we have a whole cluster of spins lift off. And so the degree of freedom is actually the domain wall. And this carries an energy J by 2. That's the reason for the fact that specific heat corresponds to a gas of these domain walls, each carrying an energy J by 2. Now, the way to see these in experiments is actually to introduce some dynamics, allow hopping of these domain walls. And that can be achieved by means of a transverse field. Because if you add a transverse field, then this can flip spins and allow domain walls to propagate. So if we label the state having the domain wall side I and J, and say now we sum up all the lattice signs, so what will happen is this operator can flip the spins left and right of the domain wall, so we would allow hopping. So I plus 1 J, sorry, minus 1 J. And similarly, it will act in this neighborhood here. So we'll flip this up and flip this down, and so we'll allow hopping of I, J plus 1 plus I, J minus 1. And of course, there will be some other terms where the field flips spins inside the cluster, but these cost a much higher energy here, 2J, so we neglect these other things. So the fundamental physics here is that the two domain walls actually move independently of each other. And so each one has an energy J by 2, and then minus B cos X. So the physics here is that the local spin flip actually decays into two independently propagating excitations with this dispersion relation. And so if we were to plot the dispersion relation for a single soliton, it will be gap. Something like this. However, the spin flip excitations, which would correspond to two of these particles together, would be a phase space where we create two of these particles independently, K1 and K2, and add their energy and momentum. Okay, the accessible space, phase space will be K1 plus K2, and energy will be E of K1 plus E of K2. And so this will start at twice the gap. And so when the two move in opposite directions, it would correspond to going up here. And when the two of them travel together, it corresponds to a dispersion that is actually twice the start width. So to show you how that would look like in experiments, the single particle dispersion would be this red line up here, and if we create two particles on this line, then the accessible phase space will be a continuum with dispersive boundaries in wave vector energy space. Now going at zero momentum up in energy corresponds to the situation where the two particles are created with equal momenta moving away from each other. And then this span here corresponds to the maximum relative kinetic energy that the two particles can have relative to one another. And so the boundaries here correspond to the two particles moving together at the same energy and momentum. So this is the result of neutron experiments on a particular one-dimensional Ising system, which directly observe the spread out of the intensity into a two soliton continuum. Now here, the kinetic energy, the hopping is provided by the external field, and you can see here that bandwidth indeed increases as we increase the external magnetic field. So the fundamental physics here is that the excitations are no longer spin flips, but actually a single spin flip created locally fractionalizes into two independently propagating quasiparticles. And in this case, the quasiparticles are these domain walls, or in a semi-classical picture, they correspond to pi twists of the chain. So basically, neutron comes in, flips a spin, creates these two twists, and they move away independently along the chain. They can pass through each other and come out the other end unchanged. Quite common in one-dimensional systems, not restricted to ferromagnetic chains, but even more common in the case of anti-ferromagnetic chains. And so I'm going to describe now the fractionalization in the case of the spin-half Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet. So here the Hamiltonian is spent on the dot product, and so that's why we call it isotropic. And it turns out that here fluctuations are sufficiently strong that there's no longer end order, even at zero temperature, so the expectation value of the spin is zero. There are only parallel correlations along the chain. However, locally, spins are still correlated in some pattern that reflects their antiferromagnetic tendency. And so we can again construct a physical picture for the excitations, starting from this diagram here and thinking about what happens when we flip over a spin. So say we flipped over that one. So this again has broken two bonds. And by analogy to the pictures we drew here, we again have two domain walls. Now, to see whether this is an elementary excitation or not, we apply the Hamiltonian onto this. And because the Hamiltonian has these transverse terms, there's plus and minus, what will happen, the Hamiltonian will, the transverse terms will apply, for example, to this pair up here, and flip this up and this down. And the effect of that will be basically to hop the domain wall by two sides. And independently, this could happen, of course, on the other side. So one way to think about these domain walls is that if we were to insert here another spin of the right orientation, basically, this would look like there's no defect. And so here we can think that we have a missing spin and a half, which can propagate away independently from this other one missing a half. And so a physical picture of the excitations here could be constructed thinking about these missing spin halves, that if I was to add them in, then the change will be perfectly correlated as before. And so because the spin-ons can hop every two sides, then the dispersion relation is restricted to half the Brillouin zone, so it goes from 0 to pi. And so in an neutron scattering experiment where we flip a spin and so create two of those, we have to think of the phase space that we reach by creating two of these and adding momenta and energy. So we, of course, can create one spin-on with zero energy, and so transfer all the energy and momentum to the second one. Or we can create both of them with the same momentum and same energy, and so that would correspond to a dispersion that has twice the periodicity and twice the bandwidth. And similarly, we can show that there is another lower boundary beyond there. So again, we have a continuum. This corresponds to both of them traveling together with no relative kinetic energy. This corresponds to all the kinetic energy given to one of them. And so the bandwidth, the fact that there's a continuum here, is a characteristic signature that they are deconfined, so they can separate away independently. So
they
always look like what you draw, but I know you're a square bevel, so it's hard to touch. Show some exceptions.
What do they look like?
Okay, so here are some experimental results on quasi-one-dimensional Heisenberg planes. These are systems where the interchain interactions are very small, maybe of the order of a percent or so. And so you can see that the intensities indeed in neutron scattering is well contained within these two sinusoidally propagating dispersion relations, a lower boundary and an upper boundary, with some intensity modulation in between. Okay. There are several systems. This was probably one of the first ones to be looked at, and then that was followed by several other systems. And so, again, the spread of this continuum corresponds to basically the extent to which one can give relative kinetic energy to one particle as opposed to the other one. So it's a characteristic signature of fractionalization. Now it turns out that also when one couples chains together, even by strong interactions, such as in this case here, where the interchain interaction is about a third of the main exchange interaction, as long as that coupling occurs via frustrated interactions, and in this case is via a zigzag interaction, so if these two, if this spin is up and this is down, basically the net effect on this one at the mean field level is zero. So when chains are coupled by frustrated interactions, even quite strong ones, it turns out the spin-ons can still survive to higher dimensions. And here are experiments on this material here, again seeing the characteristic signature of fractionalization, which is this wide bandwidth of continuum scattering corresponding to a very large relative kinetic energy between the two particles that become deconfined upon locally created spin flip excitation and neutron scattering quotients. So another understanding that came from these experiments is that even though the real material has some additional interactions which make it longer in order and have spinners at low energies, the physics of the ordered state actually is only a very small part of the full dynamical response. So for example here, this shows a scan going up in energy, and at low energies, you indeed see a sharp peak as corresponding to a spinner excitation. However, this is followed later on by a very broad continuum scattering, which you can see the integrated area under this continuum is much larger than the integrated area under the sharp peak. So this suggested that even though the system was perturbed away from a phase which would have only spin-on excitations, if we probe the physics at large enough scales of order J, we actually see the fundamental degrees of freedom of the system. However, if we were to probe it only at low energies, then we would be unaware of the fact that the system is actually very close to a deconfined phase. So one needs to probe the physics at energy scales of the exchange J in order to test for deconfinement. Whether fractionalization can occur in truly two-dimensional and three-dimensional systems where spin-ons actually have a dispersion sampling not just one dimension but actually two-dimensional dispersion or 3D. Okay. So the consensus is that in order to achieve this, one needs to have some frustration or some competing tendency to basically suppress the tendency of the system to magnetically order and have spinner excitation. So frustration is essential. To avoid. And frustration can be achieved by two means. One is by lattice geometry. So, and I've given you an example of a triangular lattice. So triangular, and even more frustrated lattice is Kagome, which can be constructed from the hexagonal lattice by lifting some of the sides, or three dimensions of pyrochlor. And one can also achieve frustration by means of non-Heisenberg interactions. For example, on the honeycomb lattice, a model in which the spin interactions are bond dependent, for example, on this bond up here will be minus Z, Z, on this bond up here minus S, X, S, X, and here minus S, Y, S, Y, and so on. All the bonds in the system will be labeled Z, X, Y. This is called the Kitaev model. This is frustrating because on each bond, even though spins want to be parallel, it's at the end of the bond, it's the other spin components that are correlated. So this leads to a short range order state with spin on excitation. And it's one of the very few exactly solvable models in 2D. So in principle, there are many possibilities. For example, in 2D, many possibilities. In principle, for what the spin on dispersion spectrum should be like. So one can have gap spin ons, where the spectrum is fully gapped. One can have a Dirac spectrum, with gapless points at some particular points. In reciprocal space, or even more exotic, one can have a Fermi surface. So these gapless points can form a contour, and one can have a Fermi surface. So in kx, ky, energy equals zero is some sort of contour like that. And there are now a number of candidate models to look for this type of physics, and I just want to briefly mention two of them. So here is the Kagome lattice. So it's got corner shared triangles, and it's highly frustrated. And this particular material here, that's been studied by the MIT group, shows very interesting behavior. It doesn't show long-range magnetic ordering, and so the excitations seem to be dominated by strong continuum scattering that extends up to very high energies. And these are some slices in momentum space at different energies with some intensity modulations in reciprocal space. So the presence of the continuum is, of course, one of the characteristic signatures of fractionalization. What's intriguing these experiments is actually the fact that there's no low boundary that could be resolved experimentally for the onset of the continuum scattering. So where that means that one of the two spin-ons is actually on a flat band, very close to zero energy, and the other spin-on is actually dispersing over a very wide band, or whether spin-ons have a Fermi surface, so there's a lot of gapless points. It would be very interesting to sort out theoretically and experimentally. Another class of materials, I'm only showing here one representative, there are several others now, is the case of triangular organic systems. In this particular material here, these are NMR measurements to show that there's no change in the NMR signal, so no internal fields, as a function of cooling to temperatures much, much lower, several orders of magnitude lower than the energy scale of the interactions, as one might expect in the case of a spin liquid ground state. And to contrast, this is another material which does show long range magnetic ordering, and the spectrum changes quite dramatically. This shows a number of interesting properties also in transport and specific heat. Thermal transport and specific heat. Now the challenge here would be really to be able to probe the physics at energy scales of J of the main interaction. See really whether you have spin-ons or some other exotic behavior. In 3D systems, there's also very interesting candidates based on the 3D pyrochlore lattice, the lattice of corner shared tetrahedra. It turns out that if one has localizing spins at each corner of the tetrahedra with an anisotropy axis that forces them to point towards the center of the tetrahedron, then for a single tetrahedron, in the presence of ferromagnetic interactions, then the graph is not unique, but there are actually, after the 16 possible spin configurations, six of them corresponding to two in, two out, are all ground states. And so when this is now mapped to the full 3D lattice, this results in a very large degeneracy, and this is an example of a classical spin liquid, and by analogy to the proton ordering in water ice, this has been dubbed spin ice. So what's interesting here is that not only the ground state shows this extensive degeneracy, but also excited states show very interesting structure. So if we flip a spin in a state, in a spin ice state with two in, where all tetrahedra are two in, two out, flip one spin, then this, these two connected tetrahedras both are going to be three in, one out, and three out, one in. So they're going to have some defects in them. However, if we go to the next tetrahedra connected to this, if we flip this spin, then we restore this to an equilibrium configuration and essentially move the defect here. And so by doing subsequent flips like this, the two defect tetrahedra can be separated away from each other independently. And this again is the fundamental idea behind fractionalization, that a local excitation fractionalizes into two components that move away independently. So, very schematically, the understanding for the 3D systems, so fractionalization in 3D. Is that we have in terms of energy, there are many degenerate ground states, so there's high density of states at zero energy. And also, if we flip a spin, so that's the spin flip manifold, then we again have a very large degenerate manifold corresponding to these two excitations, which are called monopoles. Due to special mapping that can be made in mathematical treatment of them. So there are a number of theoretical predictions suggesting that if we add the suitable type of quantum dynamics, then one can lift the degeneracy in the ground state manifold to stabilize just a singlet ground state. And an excitation exists which samples this previously degenerate manifold, that's called the photon. And also one might expect that this quantum dynamics allows the monopoles to hop and acquire dynamics. So one expects perhaps a continuum of dispersing monopoles. So there's now a lot of evidence, experimental evidence, to suggest that indeed in classical spin ice, one finds monopoles in static properties, it would be very interesting to see whether there could be evidence for dispersing monopoles in the dynamics. So see monopoles directly, see their dispersion directly. So to discuss some of the experimental challenges that we're now facing in seeing this sort of this type of physics. So first of all, we need good candidate materials. And now there's a lot of understanding for theory, what are some of the key ingredients and what to look for. Now also very important is we need large single crystals of these materials, and that's really a material synthesis challenge. Because with single crystals, one can do many more quantitative experiments to look directly at the correlations and test some of these scenarios for exotic excitations. Then, in fractionalized systems, the scattering weight is actually spread out over a very wide range of energy and momentum. So there's a total sum rule in neutron scattering which says that the total intensity integrated over the full Brillouin zone and all energies is S times S plus 1. So when this scattering is concentrated in a single magnon, then you know, it's very easy to see, very strong signal. However, if it's spread out over a very wide space, then it's much more challenging to see. So we need high sensitivity and wide coverage. And there has been progress in neutron instrumentation to meet this challenge. I just want to highlight the fact that we now have some new neutron sources. There's the SNS, spallation neutron source, Oak Ridge. There's also a new neutron source in Japan. And the ICES neutron source, where I did most of experiments, also suffered many upgrades. So, for example, this data set I showed you earlier with the confinement of solitons, this was collected on an instrument which had 50 detector tubes. Nowadays, instrument LET at ICES has over 40,000 detector channels, all collecting data simultaneously, and over 4 meter tubes. There's a wide coverage, pi star radians, and the instrument has been really engineered to have very low background, so extremely high sensitivity. So much more quantitative experiments and high resolution can now be made than in the past. Now, neutron scattering is not the only technique to look at excitations. There's also been much progress in the use of resonant inelastic X-ray scattering, RICs. So X-rays are not normally sensitive to spin, but if the wavelength is tuned to have an internal transition from one of the core levels to the orbital where the magnetic electrons are sitting, then X-ray absorption actually depends on the spin orientation, and there's a very strong resonant enhancement of the scattering intensity. And here's an example of inelastic X-ray measurements done on a one-dimensional cuprate system, showing clear evidence for the spin-on continuum at low energies. And also some of the high energy excitations here, even combined spin-on and orbiton excitations. So this is a technique which overcomes the requirement to have very large single crystals for neutron scattering. Here experiments can be done on materials with 1 millimeter size crystals. However, the resolution is such that one needs quite high energy scales, and probably this won't be very suitable for organics because of the beam damage. But several other systems, this I think is a promising technique that could be important in the future. So, because the physics is highly complex in these systems, it's actually important not to just do the experiment at one point in phase space, but actually have some tuning parameters. So of course, we always have temperature, but it would be useful to do experiments of spatial pressure and magnetic field, for example, to look at the trends of the spectrum as a function of these tuning parameters and develop first an experimental physical picture of what's going on and then compare it with theory. So one strategy that we found very useful in our earlier research on low-dimensional systems was to apply a strong enough magnetic field to basically fully polarize the spins. And so this stabilizes essentially a classical state for which the spinner description is perfectly adequate. And so measuring experimentally the dispersion relation gives us a direct image of the spin Hamiltonian. So measure experimentally the spin Hamiltonian. And with this knowledge, then one can say a lot about what happens here at low field, where quantum fluctuations dominate. And one can extract quantum renormalization factors, and so on. And so this research strategy is actually very successfully been applied now to many other systems, and I think will be quite important in our tool, range of tools to be used to probe exotic quantum states. Now, the positive outlook here is that even though there are many challenges, we expect rather rich physics. For example, in magnetic field, if you have a system with spin-ons, then if the spin-ons are fermions, then one can expect band filling of fermions. If they're bosons, there's Bose condensation, and so on. Effects of perturbations may be very important. One could see new types of phase transitions. And also confinement spectrum of spin-ons may be very rich. And we already know from experiments in 1D that under the effect of attractive interactions, spinons or solitons in this case, can form a very rich spectrum of bound states. For example, in this material here, the fundamental excitations are indeed these solitons. However, when there's long-range three-dimensional magnetic ordering, then every time a dominant wall hops onto one chain, it basically has to pay an energy cost from breaking the bond with the neighboring chain. And that is an energy cost which depends on J prime and the expectation value of the state. And this energy cost increases every time you move one side. So basically, this is a potential with linear walls. And under those conditions, then the two particles have a spectrum of confined bound states where the energy of the bound states corresponds to stretching the string tension to overcome the confinement potential. And this is indeed seen in experiments. You see here five bound states of spinons, and their energies are actually in very good agreement with model predictions for confinement under a linear attractive potential. And one can also make here analogies with particle physics in the sense that this attractive interaction is typical to quarks, and so solitons are quarks, and so their bound states are sometimes called Ising mesons. It would be very interesting if some of this physics or related to this of confinement of spinons with non-conserved spin could actually be realized in higher dimensional systems. So I'd like to end up by saying that it's very important for progress in the field to have this interaction between theory, experiment, and material synthesis. And each of these three is actually very important in enabling progress in the field. So I hope this program will foster this type of interaction. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about how, you said you need good candidate materials, how, what's the exercise by which, I mean, do you go from material you know to evolve it, or do you, how do these materials look very complex? So the question is, how do you find them, how do you choose them?
So one strategy is to look for certain lattices, where sort of theoretical guidance has suggested that there's interesting physics, and see if you can fit the right type of ions to realize the right type of interactions. So I can, so for example, I can just illustrate that with some of the materials I've discussed so far. So for example, in this material here, we're looking for an Ising chain that would have a suitable energy scale to be tuned by an external magnetic field. Because if you can match the internal field energy scale with a magnetic field, then you can introduce quantum phase transitions and so on. So then I looked at a large variety of one-dimensional systems. Copper is usually isotropic, but cobalt has a strong spin orbit coupling to the lattice, and that gives it anisotropy. And then I looked at systems where the energy scale, where the exchange happened through 90 degree bonds, and that is very much weaker than the normal exchange through 180 degrees, where you'd need Tesla to get the transition. And then I looked for a system that you could grow as cubic centimeters. And that really narrows down the list. And so the system had the key ingredients, what I was looking for, but it had a lot more. And it turns out that actually the physics was much richer than we initially anticipated. That's, you know, very often the case. But I think if you look for a system with the key ingredients put you into the right phase space, then chances are, even if you don't discover what you were looking for, there'll be still some interesting physics. again, in some...
So, for example, this is a case that you did, you're saying?
That's right.
So how many failed other combinations did you try?
Well, we looked for some triangular spin half Heisenberg systems. And we found one that started in life as a spin half Heisenberg triangular unfair magnet. But actually, the electrons were mobile, and it turned out that the system wanted to do charge ordering, and then, you know, physics was completely different. It was still interesting, not for the reasons we initially wanted to look at it, but, you know, we pursued the physics until the very end and found some other interesting physics. Yeah, we've looked at you know, systems that were candidates for Kitaic physics, and we probably found something related to that, but not quite what we're looking for. I think there's, you know, quite a number of sort of the phase space is really unexplored experimentally. So if you find a good candidate system that does something interesting, then developing the experimental technique to understand in depth everything that it does can be quite rewarding. Even though, you know, you may have wanted to explore that system to you know, explore a certain type of physics, you may find something else, but still interesting. With experiments, we have no control over what nature will do. Yeah.
Questions? So you said you grew, you wanted to find a material that you could grow like centimeter sized.
That's right, yeah.
Do you know that a priori, or do you have to just try it and see if you're going to get it that big?
Well, there are some rules of thumb. So in this particular case, this worked very well because it's an oxide, so it grows, it's stable up to very high temperatures. And there are not many other combinations of cobalt and hydrogen oxide that would form this. If you try with copper, that's a completely different. Copper actually forms in two polytypes, and it's really complex, actually. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, you can look at families of materials, and sometimes you can substitute A for B and C, whatever. But some of the times, if you just change one ion with something else, because the radius is ever so slightly bigger or smaller, it goes somewhere else in the lattice. So, and then, you know, material synthesis comes into play, because you can stabilize other phases if you synthesize the material the right route, if you put high pressures and so on. So, you know, diamond and carbon are of the same material, but diamond is a high pressure phase. So, yeah, you can stabilize a lot more materials if you're prepared to follow the right synthesis route.
So what is the high energy band? It's the conventional magnum extension.
So in this material here?
Yeah. That one around the 3 milli electron volt.
Yes. That actually,
why the part is so sharply separated from the low energy band?
That's right. We can think of this in terms of a spin wave, but also I think it here is more suitably thought in terms of the kinetic bound state of two solitons. So I showed you earlier this phase space down here. Now you see in this region of phase space here, there's very little relative kinetic energy between the two particles. And so it turns out that if you add an interaction in the Hamiltonian, which is of this type, SX is X plus SY is Y, which is that. Basically, what that does, if the two solitons are near each other, if this transit dies, it can hop both of them together on the next side.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's an extra kinetic energy gain that the two solitons can obtain if they travel together.
Mm.
So basically, if I was to add to this the XY interaction, what will happen? A shard mode will lift off here and it will have a dispersion like that. So that's a kinetic bound state as opposed to states down here which correspond to potential energy bound states.
But separation is so sharp in this compound. Is it very specific to this compound?
Well, kinetic bound states have been predicted in other systems as well. Basically, it's an energy gain when to hopping when the two particles are close to each other. There are predictions that, for example, in this other material we looked at here, Leon Valence has a theory to suggest that if the spinons are coupled together, they can hop between chains, but individual spinons cannot hop separately. And so that gives rise to a triplon bound state, which would occur only at very specific points in reciprocal space, where the continuum narrows. No, that's a characteristic feature. And when the continuum narrows, the relative kinetic energy is small, so other terms can have a significant effect. And so, basically, and there's experimental support for that kind of idea in the sense that if we measure this in a reciprocal space moving between the chains, and the continuum becomes asymmetric, loses a lot of weight here, and there's the sharp mode here. Yeah, I think kinetic bound states are a bit unusual, but they can occur in other systems. In this particular case, here, I think it's very well observed, and one can also see that as this bound state overlaps with the continuum, the dispersion sort of moves away to intersect the continuum, not at right angle but tangentially. Yeah. So yeah, it's a kinetic bound state.
Yeah.
Thank you.